This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Ground of Education. This is lecture 4, entitled The Art of Educating Young Children, given on August 19, 1922. It might seem as though the art of education, as described in these lectures, would lead away from practical life into some remote, purely spiritual region, as though this kind of education stressed the purely spiritual domain too much. From what I have said so far, in describing the spiritual foundation of the education, this might appear to be the case. But it only seems this way. In reality, the art of education that arises from this philosophy has the most practical objectives. Thus it should be realized that the main reason for speaking of spiritual facts here is to answer the educational question, how can we best develop the physical organism of children and youths? It may look like a fundamental contradiction when a spiritual philosophy considers the development of the physical organism first. My theme during the next few days, however, will do more toward dispelling this contradiction than any abstract statements I could make at the beginning. Today I would just like to say that anyone who speaks on questions of education today is put in a peculiar situation. If one sees much in education that needs reforming, it is like expressing a dissatisfaction with one's own education. It implies that one's own education has been very poor. And one presumes to know the right way to educate, even as the product of this very bad education in which there is so much to criticize. Otherwise, why be a reformer? This is the first contradiction. The second gives one a slight feeling of shame when facing an audience and speaking on education. For one is speaking of what education should be and how it must be changed from present practice. It amounts to saying that you are all badly educated. And yet one appeals to those who are badly educated so that we can bring about a better education. One assumes that both the speaker and the audience know very well what good education should be, despite the fact that they have been very badly educated. Now this is a contradiction, but it is one that life presents us, and in fact it can be solved only through the kind of education being described here. One can thoroughly recognize the problems with education and where it needs improvement, just as you can see that a picture is painted well without having the slightest capacity for painting yourself. You can consider yourself able to appreciate the merits of a picture by Raphael without thinking you can paint such a picture. In fact, it would be a good thing today if people would think like this, but they are not content with merely knowing. Where education is concerned, people claim immediately to know how to educate. It is like someone who is not a painter and could never become a painter, but who, nevertheless, sets out to show how a badly painted picture should have been painted. The assertion here is that it's not enough to know what good education is. Rather, one must have a grasp of the technique and detail of education as an art, and one must gain practical skill. Knowledge and understanding are needed for this. Thus, yesterday, I tried to explain the basic principles for guidance in this ability, and now I will continue this review. It is easy to say that we develop during our lifetime, and that we develop in successive stages, but this is not enough. Yesterday we saw that the human being is threefold in nature, that human thinking is physically connected with the nervous system, feeling is related to the rhythmic system, particularly the breathing and circulation system, and that volition is related to the system of movement and metabolism. The development of these three human systems varies. Through the various phases of life, they develop in different ways. During the first, until the change of teeth, as I have repeatedly stated, children are all sense organ and head, and all development proceeds from the nervous system. This system permeates the whole organism, and all outer impressions affect the organism as a whole, working right through it, just as light affects the eye later in life. In other words, in an adult, light comes to a standstill in the eye and sends only an idea of itself, a concept of light, into the organism. In children, it's as though every little blood corpuscle were inwardly illumined and transfused with light, to give it a somewhat exaggerated and pictorial expression. At this stage, children are entirely exposed to these etheric essences, which in later life we arrest in the sense organs at the surface of our bodies, while inwardly we develop something entirely different. Thus, children are exposed far more to sensory impressions than adults are. Observe a concrete example of this. Imagine a man who has charge of nurturing of a very young child, perhaps a tiny baby. He is a person with his own world of inner experience. Imagine that this person is a heavy-hearted being, one to whom life has brought sorrow. In the mature man, the physical consequences of those experiences will not be obvious, having left only faint traces. When we are sad, the mouth is always a little dry, and when sadness becomes a habit and a continuous state, the sorrowful person goes about with dry mouth, a dry tongue, a bitter taste in the mouth, and even a chronic inflammation of the mucous membrane. In adults, these physical conditions are merely faint undertones of life. A child growing up in the company of an adult is an imitator. Children model themselves entirely on what they perceive in the appearance of the adult, for example, an adult's sad way of speaking or sad feelings. There is a subtle interplay of imponderables between children and adults. When we experience inner sadness with all its physical manifestations, a child, being an imitator, takes up these physical effects through inner gestures. Through inward mimicry, a child might assume, say, a dry tongue or bitter taste in the mouth, and this, as I pointed out yesterday, flows through the whole organism. Or a child absorbs the pale, sad face of an adult. Children cannot imitate the soul substance of sorrow itself, but they do imitate the physical appearance of the sorrow. Consequently, because spirit is still working into a child's organism, the whole organism will be permeated in such a way that it builds the organs according to the physical manifestations the child has taken in. Thus, the very condition of the growing organism will make a sad being of the child. In later life, this person will have a particular aptitude for perceiving anything sad or sorrowful. Such is the subtle, delicate knowledge one needs to educate properly. This is the way of life for children until the change of teeth. They are entirely surrendered to what the organism has absorbed from adults around them. And the inner conflict here is perceptible only to spiritual science. This struggle can be described only as a fight between inherited characteristics and adaptation to environment. We are born with certain inherited characteristics, and this can be seen by anyone who has the opportunity to observe a child during the earliest weeks and years. Science has produced an extensive body of knowledge on this subject. But children have to adapt more and more to the world. Little by little, they must transform their inherited characteristics, until they do not merely carry their heredity, but open their senses, soul, and spirit to receive the events of the greater environment. Otherwise, they become egotistic people who want only what agrees with the inherited characteristics. Now, we have to educate people to be receptive to all that goes on in the world, so that, whenever they see something new, they can bring their judgment and feelings to meet it. We must not educate people to be self-absorbed. Rather, we must educate people to meet the world with free and open minds, to act in harmony with all that the world requires. This attitude is a natural outcome of the approach I described yesterday. Thus, we must closely observe the inner struggle that takes place during children's early years between heredity and adaptation to the environment. Try to study with the greatest human devotion the wonderful process in which the first teeth are replaced by the second. The first teeth are inherited. They seem almost unsuitable for the outer world. Gradually, above each inherited tooth, another tooth forms. In shaping each tooth, the form of the first is used, but the form of the second permanent tooth is adapted to the world. I always refer to this process of changing teeth as characteristic of this particular period of life, up to the seventh year. But it is only one indication. What happens to the teeth is conspicuous, because teeth are hard organs, but the process takes place throughout the organism. When we are born into this world, we carry within us an inherited organism. During the first 7 years of life, we form a new organism over it. The whole process is physical. But although it is physical, it is the work of spirit and soul within a child. Then those of us who are close to children must try to guide them in soul and spirit, so that their inner being goes with rather than against the health of the organism. We must therefore know what spirit and soul processes are needed for a child to form a healthy organism to replace the inherited organism. We must be able to understand and work spiritually to promote the physical. Now, to continue from what I said by way of introduction today, we come to something else. Suppose, as teachers, we are entering a classroom. We must never imagine that we are the most intelligent people, at the summit of human intelligence. This, in fact, would show that we are very poor teachers. Rather, we should think of ourselves as only relatively intelligent. This is a more realistic mindset than the other. Now, in this state of consciousness, we enter the classroom. As we enter, we must remember that among these children there may be a very intelligent being, one who in later life will be far more intelligent than we. Now, if we, who are only relatively intelligent, were to bring up this child to be only as intelligent as ourselves, we would render him merely a copy of ourselves. This would be quite wrong. The correct approach would be to educate this very intelligent individual to grow and become far more intelligent than we could ever be. This means that there is something in a person that we must not touch, something we must approach with sensitive reverence, if we are to exercise the art of education properly. This is part of the answer to the question I asked. Often, in early life, we know very well what we should do, but we cannot carry it out. We feel inadequate. The obstacle that prevents us from doing what we should is usually very obscure, but it is always a condition of the physical organism. For example, it may be a disposition toward sadness acquired through imitation, such as I spoke of. The organism incorporated this tendency, and it has become a habit. Now we want to do something that does not suit an organism inclined toward sadness. Within us we have the effects of the dry tongue and bitter taste from childhood, and now we want to do something different, and we experience difficulty. If we realize the full significance of this, we might tell ourselves that a teacher's primary task is to nurture the body to be as healthy as possible. This means that we use every spiritual measure to ensure that in later life a person's body will be the least possible hindrance to the will of one's spirit. If we make this our purpose in school, we can develop the forces that lead to an education for freedom. The extent to which spiritual education has a healthy effect on the physical organism and on the person as a whole becomes especially obvious when the vast range of facts given by our modern natural science is gathered and coordinated as only spiritual science can do. Thus we can see how to work in the spirit of the healing. Let me read that again. Thus we can see how to work in the spirit of the healing of the human being. Take a particular instance. The English doctor, Sir Clifford Allbutt, 1836 to 1925, made a very significant statement about how human grief and sadness affect the development of the digestive organs, the kidneys in particular. After a while, people who experience a great many problems and grief in life show signs of malformed kidneys. This has been very finely demonstrated by Dr. Albert and is a discovery of natural science. The important thing is that we know how to use a scientific discovery like this in educational practice. As teachers, we must recognize that to the degree that we allow children to imitate our own sorrow and grief, our bearing greatly damages their digestive system. You see, this is the tragedy of this materialistic age. Many physical facts are discovered, but the relationships are missing. It is this materialistic science that fails to perceive the true significance of the physical and material. The contribution of spiritual science is to show in every case how spirit works and its effects in the physical realm. Then, instead of indulging in dreamy mysticism that yearns for castles in the clouds, it follows spirit in every detail and activity. We are spiritual beings only when we recognize spirit as creator, the agent that works on and shapes the material world. It is not the worship of some abstract spirit in the clouds, like mysticism, which in general considers matter to be merely a concern of the material world. Hence, in young children, until the seventh year, we are concerned with recognizing the pervasive interplay of sensory and nerve activity, the rhythmic activity of breathing and circulation, and the activity of movement and metabolism. And it is the nerve and sense activity that predominates and has the upper hand. Thus, sensory activity in children always affects their breathing. If they have to look at a face furrowed by grief, it affects their senses first, then their breathing, and in turn their whole movement and metabolic system. In children after the change of teeth, around the seventh year, we find that the nervous system no longer dominates. It has become more separate and is turned more toward the outer world. In these children, until puberty, it is the rhythmic system that dominates and takes the upper hand. It is most important to keep this in mind during elementary school, when we have children between the change of teeth and puberty. Hence, we must see that it is essential to work with the rhythmic system, and that anything affecting the other systems is wrong. But what affects the rhythmic system? It is affected by art, anything conveyed in an artistic form. Just think of how everything musical is related to the rhythmic system. Music is nothing but rhythm carried into the human rhythmic system. The inner human being becomes a lyre or violin. One's whole rhythmic system produces what the violin or piano has played. And as it is with music, so it is in a finer, more delicate way with modeling and painting. Color harmonies and melodies are also reproduced and live as inner rhythmic processes within us. Before our teaching can become truly educational, we must know that everything children are taught throughout this period must be conveyed artistically. According to Waldorf principles, the first consideration in the elementary school means composing all lessons in a way that appeals to the rhythmic system of children. There is little regard for this today. We see this in the continually accumulating scientific observations that completely contradict this appeal to the rhythmic system. Research in experimental psychology attempts to determine how quickly children tire of one activity or another, and then instructors are supposed to take this into account. This is all very well, as long as we do not think spiritually. But if we do, the matter appears in a very different light. Experiments can still be made, and they are very good. Nothing is said here against the excellence of natural science. But we say that if children between the change of teeth and puberty show a certain amount of fatigue, you have not appealed in the right way to the rhythmic system, but to some other system. Throughout life, the rhythmic system never tires. The heart beats night and day. Instead, fatigue affects the intellect and the metabolism. When we know that we must appeal to the rhythmic system, we know that we must work artistically. Experiments on fatigue show where we have gone wrong, where we have given too little attention to the rhythmic system. When we discover that a child has become overly fatigued, we must ask ourselves how we can plan our lessons to avoid this. We do not set ourselves up to condemn modernity, claiming that natural science is bad and must be opposed. Spiritual people have no such intention. Rather, they will say that we need a higher view, because this is precisely what allows us to apply natural scientific results to life. If we now turn to the moral aspect, we must find the best way to encourage children to develop moral impulses. Here we are concerned with the most important of all educational issues. We do not endow children with moral impulses by giving them commands, saying that they must do this or that or such and such is good. We do not do this by trying to prove that something is good and must be done, or by saying that something is wicked and must not be done. Children do not yet have the intellectual attitude of adults toward good and evil, and the whole realm of morality. They must grow into it. This arises only with puberty, after the rhythmic system has accomplished its basic task, when the intellectual forces are ripe for complete development. Then a person may experience the satisfaction of moral discernment in life itself. We must not force moral judgment on children. We merely lay the foundation so that when children awaken at puberty, they can form their own moral judgments by observing life. The least effective way to attain this is by giving children finite commands, rather to work through examples or by presenting images to their imagination, say through biographies or descriptions of good or bad people, or by inventing circumstances that present a picture of goodness to their mind. Because the rhythmic system is especially active in children during this period, pleasure and displeasure can arise in them, but not judgment of good and evil. They can experience sympathy with what is good in an image, or a feeling of antipathy toward the evil seen in an image. It is not a matter of appealing to children's intellect by saying, "Thou shalt" or "Thou shalt not." It is rather a matter of nurturing aesthetic judgment, so that children begin to feel pleasure and sympathy when they see goodness, and feel dislike and antipathy when they see evil. This is very different from working on the intellect through precepts formed by the intellect. Children will not be awake to intellectual precepts until they are no longer ours to educate, when they become adults and learn from life itself. We should not rob them of the satisfaction of awaking to morality on their own. And we will not do this if we prepare them properly during the rhythmic period of their life. Working through imagery, we must train them to take an aesthetic pleasure in goodness and feel an aesthetic dislike of evil. Otherwise, when children do awake after puberty, they will experience an inward bondage, perhaps not consciously, but throughout life they will lack the important experience of moral discernment, awakening, and developing within. Abstract moral instruction will not accomplish this awakening. It must be prepared by working correctly in this way in children. Thus, it is always a matter of how something is done. We see this both in the part of life concerned with the outer world and in the part concerned with morality, when we study the realm of nature in the most appropriate way, and when we know the best way to plant morals in the rhythmic system of breathing and blood circulation. Once we know how to enter with spirit into the physical, and once we begin to see how spirit weaves continuously in the physical, we will be able to educate in the right way. Although knowledge of the human being is sought in the first instance for the art of education, Nevertheless, in practice, the effect of such a spiritual view on the teacher's state of mind has tremendous importance. This can be shown best in relation to the attitude of many of our contemporaries. No doubt every age has its shadow side, and there is much in the past that we have no wish to revive. Nevertheless, anyone who can look at human history with a certain intuition will perceive that in our time there are many who have very little inner joy. On the contrary, people are burdened by heavy doubts and questions in terms of destiny. This age has less capacity than any other for deriving its answers from the universe as a whole. Although I might become very unhappy in myself, and with good reason, yet it is always possible to find something in the universe to counter my unhappiness. But modern humankind lacks the strength to find consolation in a universal view as long as personal situations make people downcast. Why is this? It is because the education and development of people today provide little opportunity to gain a feeling of gratitude, gratitude that we are alive at all as human beings in this universe. Correctly speaking, all human feelings should function from a fundamental sense of gratitude that the cosmos has given us birth and a place within the universe. Any philosophy that ends with abstract observations and fails to flow out in gratitude toward the universe is an incomplete philosophy. The final chapter of every philosophy, its effect on human feeling, should be gratitude toward the cosmic powers. This feeling is essential in teachers and should be instinctive in anyone entrusted with nurturing a child. Therefore, the first important thing to be worked for in spiritual knowledge is thankfulness that the universe has given a child into our keeping. In this sense, we should never be cut off from reverence and thankfulness for children. We need only one attitude toward children to educate and nurture them correctly, an attitude of reverence, no more and no less. We feel reverence toward many things. A meadow flower can make us feel reverence when we view it as a creation of the cosmic divine spiritual order. Flashing lightning in the clouds make us feel reverence if we can see it in terms of the world's divine spiritual order. And above all, we should feel reverence toward children, because they come to us from the depths of the universe as the highest manifestation of its nature. They bring tidings of the world's essence. Within this feeling, we find one of the most important impulses of educational method. This educational method has a different quality from methods devoted to non-spiritual matters. Educational technique is essentially a moral impulse of reverence in teachers. Now, you may say that although people are extremely objective toward many things today, things of less vital importance perhaps, we will nevertheless find those who consider it a tragedy that they should feel religious toward a child who may turn out to be completely useless and ineffectual. And why should we consider it a tragedy if a child turns out unsuccessful? As we said before, there are many parents, even in our age of objectivity, who admit that their children are completely useless. This was not true in former times, when all children were good in their parents' eyes. This was a healthier attitude than the modern one. Nevertheless, we feel it as a tragedy if the spirit worlds give us the gift of a difficult child as a manifestation of the highest. But we must live through this feeling of tragedy, because it is this very feeling that will help us over the rocks and crags of education. If we can feel gratitude even for a difficult child, and also feel the tragedy of it, and if we can rouse ourselves to overcome this feeling of tragedy, then we will be in a position to feel gratitude to the divine world. For we must learn to perceive how something, in quotes, bad, can also be something divine, although this is a very complicated matter. Gratitude must permeate teachers of children up to the change of teeth. It must be their fundamental mood. Then we come to the part of a child's development based primarily on the rhythmic system. As we have seen, here we must work artistically in teaching. And we shall never accomplish this unless we can join an attitude of reverence toward the child with a love of our educational activity. We must saturate our teaching with love. While children are between the change of teeth and puberty, all our teaching must be done out of love for teaching itself. Otherwise, it will have no good effect on them. We must tell ourselves that no matter how clever a teacher may be, the lives of children reveal infinitely significant spiritual divine matters. But for our part, our love must surround our spiritual efforts toward children in education. Consequently, no pedagogy should be purely intellectual. The only guidance we should engage is that which helps us teach with loving enthusiasm. In a Waldorf school, who the teachers are is far more important than any technical ability they may have acquired intellectually. It is important that teachers not only love the children, but also love the whole procedure they use. It is not enough for teachers to love the children. They must also love teaching, and love it with objectivity. This constitutes the spiritual foundation of spiritual, moral, and physical education. If we can acquire this love for teaching, we will be able to develop children up to the age of puberty, so that when that time arrives, we will be able to hand them over to the freedom and the use of their own intelligence. If we have received children in religious reverence, and if we have educated them in love up to the time of puberty, then after this we will be able to leave their spirit free and interact with them as equals. Our aim is not to touch the spirit, but to let it awaken. When children reach puberty, we will best attain our goal of giving them over to freely use their intellectual and spiritual powers if we respect the spirit. We must realize that all we can do is remove hindrances from the spirit, physical hindrances and, up to a point, hindrances of the soul. What the spirit must learn, it will learn, because you have removed the impediments. If we remove impediments, spirit will develop in relation to life itself, even in very early youth. Our proper task as educators is to remove hindrances. Hence, we must make sure we do not try to turn our children, who are copies of ourselves, and that we do not forcibly and tyrannically impose ourselves on those who will naturally develop beyond us. Each child in every age brings something new into the world from divine regions, and it is our task as educators to remove the bodily and soul obstacles so that the child's spirit may enter with full freedom into life. These must become the three golden rules in the art of education, that they must imbue the whole attitude of teachers and the whole impulse of their work. The golden rules that must be embraced by a teacher's whole being, not as theory, are these. First, reverent gratitude toward the world for the child we contemplate every day. For every child presents a problem given us by divine worlds. Second, gratitude to the universe and love for what we have to do with the child. And third, respect for the child's freedom, which we must not endanger, since it is this freedom to which we must direct our teaching efforts, so that the child may one day stand at our side in freedom in the world. The end of Lecture 4.